This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm news director Sarah Bohannon. Today we're focusing on the role of science in this pandemic. We'll hear from Dr. James Zimring, a professor, blood pathologist, and author of What Science Is and How It Really Works. He'll talk to NSPR's host of Blue Dot, Dave Shlom, about everything from herd immunity to antibody testing to where we are with a vaccine. If you have questions or comments, you can leave them on our message line 433-9216 or visit our website, mynspr.org. For Friday, May 15th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Dr. James Zimring is a professor of pathology at the University of Virginia and is the author of the book, What Science Is and How It Really Works. You might have heard him previously on NSPR's program Blue Dot, speaking with host Dave Shlom about the scientific process. Today, they'll focus their conversation on science's role in this pandemic, why there's changing information coming from experts about this virus, and they'll try to give us a little more meaning behind some of the public health terms we keep seeing in the news. Here's their conversation.
Well, let's start with some simple things. Can you explain to us a bit about some concepts that we keep hearing about? Like, let's start with herd immunity. What exactly does that mean?
Sure. So when a new pathogen, and by that I mean a germ like a bacteria or a virus, enters a population, the reason you get an epidemic is that one person can infect, you know, four people, and then each of those four people can infect four people. So now you've got 16, and each of those 16 can infect four people, and so on and so forth. And you get a geometric expansion of the epidemic. But after enough people get infected and survive and are therefore immune, now when someone is sick, a lot of the people they bump into have already been infected and can't be infected again, if that is the case, and then can't pass it on and pass it on. So eventually, this process is self-limiting because so many people are immune from their previous infection that the epidemic can no longer propagate the way it does at the beginning. And that's called herd immunity.
Okay, and I'm going to circle back to that idea of immunity. Let's talk about different kinds of testing, because there's basically two different types. There's testing to see, do I have the virus? And there's testing to see if you have antibodies. Let's start with just the actual testing. What do you think about the state of things as far as the accuracy of testing and all the different labs doing it? Are the tests we're doing today, you know, what do you think of them? How has that evolved since the beginning of this?
Yeah, so like you said, there's two separate issues. The first is, do you actively have the virus in you right now? And the main way to test that is to test for RNA, so coronaviruses in general and COVID-19 in particular use RNA as their genetic material. And there's a process called a polymerase chain reaction, which can detect just the RNA from that virus. And because this test is very specific, meaning it doesn't cross-react much with other things. And so if it's a positive and it was done properly, there was no contamination or other problems, then it's usually a true positive and it's very meaningful. Sometimes you get a false negative if you don't get you don't swab the nasopharyngeal cavity properly or the sample's not handled properly. But that testing is pretty good, except that it's not very widespread right now. In my opinion, not nearly what it should be. So we're only testing people who are actively sick. We're not testing people that are feeling well, and that's important from an epidemiological standpoint and from understanding the virus. There's also a new test out there that's just been approved called an antigen test that tests not for the genetic material of the virus, but the intact virus itself, which also has advantages because sometimes the genetic material can hang around longer than the virus has actually been there. So that's testing for the virus itself. Antibody testing is testing your immune response to the virus, which is basically used to tell if you've ever had an infection. And this is a much more problematic circumstance for a number of reasons. First of all, the FDA has opened the floodgates, so to speak, and are letting all the tests come onto the market without the traditional scrutiny. And I believe that was the correct decision. But we have to fix it and clean it up after the fact, because we have to have the testing in place, but we need to understand how good it is. And why would antibody testing be more problematic than the genetic testing for the virus itself? Coronaviruses are very common. There are four types of coronavirus that basically cause the common cold. They're ubiquitous in the human population. Roughly 90% of people have antibodies against those coronaviruses. And those coronaviruses are related to COVID-19. So when you get a positive on a COVID-19 test, how do you know if that's really an antibody against COVID-19, or if that's an antibody from a cold you had last year that is cross-reacting with the COVID-19 antigens? Now, there are ways to figure this out as we go forward, and people are trying to find unique parts of the viruses that don't overlap, but that makes the antibody testing particularly challenging.
Yeah, and let's talk about, you know, the value of that antibody testing. You mentioned, you know, when we talked about immunity, what do we know so far about COVID-19 in terms of if you have the antibodies? Let's say you had a very mild case or had it and was you were asymptomatic. Does that really automatically mean that you are immune? And do we have any idea of how long that might even last?
We have some idea based upon our experience with other coronaviruses. It's too early in the COVID-19 epidemic really to understand what happens over time. I mean, we're just a few months into it, regrettably. But I want to make a distinction first that antibodies may or may not be protective against the virus. Your immune system has several different ways that it attacks things. Unlike a bacterial infection, which, you know, propagates outside of your cells and throughout your body, viruses proliferate inside your cells. And when a virus is inside your cells, antibodies can't get to it. So your immune system has a completely separate arm called cellular immunity, where a number of types of cells, including cytolytic T cells, most famously, go and they can see basically markers on the cell surface that tell it it's been infected with a virus and go in and kill the cell to kill the virus. So there's lots of viruses for which antibodies are not protective. There are viruses for which antibodies are protective, and they can certainly neutralize the viruses that are floating around outside of cells, as they have to do from time to time. So whether antibodies are protective or not is unclear, but having an antibody indicates that you've been previously exposed. Now, this raises the question of, are people that have been previously exposed immune? We have to assume that anyone who's been previously exposed and has lived has some immunity. Otherwise, they would have died from the viral infection. They did fight it off. Whether the antibodies did it or it's a cytolytic T cell response and the antibodies just indicate that. However, how long that immunity lasts and whether they can become reinfected or not is unclear. When we look at other coronaviruses, the antibodies tend to fade much faster than we're accustomed to with other types of infections. They stick around for a couple years, but then they fade off. And also, the virus has the capacity to mutate, not as quickly as a lot of other viruses do, like influenza, but it has it. And so it's kind of a competition game. So at this point, I don't think we know how long immunity lasts, but I think we can be confident that there is immunity. Otherwise, no one would ever recover.
I see. And then let's talk about the development of vaccines. Where do you think we stand on that? There's just this worldwide effort going on. Give us your take on vaccines right now.
Well, vaccines are awfully hard to predict. You know, there have been some great triumphs with vaccines in our history. We've eradicated smallpox. We have effective vaccines for measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, poliovirus, etc. But I remember, you know, when I was in med school and the HIV epidemic was just starting, we were told, oh, we'll have a vaccine in 5 years and 10 years and, you know, two decades and so on and so forth. And we're still not there. So it's a bit of a a gamble. You never know if a vaccine is going to work because every virus has its own way of trying to get around the immune system and its own particular escape mechanisms. However, I'm cautiously optimistic if for no other reason. We've learned an awful lot of immunology in the past couple decades, and there are so many efforts simultaneously underway that the likelihood of one of the vaccines showing at least partial efficacy, if not complete efficacy, is, in my opinion, reasonably high. Of course, that's not all that you need. It also has to be safe, because if it causes more problems than it solves, that's not a good deal. And we have to be able to produce it quickly enough to stop what's happening, because if this is a pandemic that goes through the entire population of the earth and you know infects 70 or 80% of people before herd immunity kicks in, and you're going to get a vaccine and you're going to immunize everybody before that happens, you're talking about what, 7 billion doses of vaccine to give to all people. Now, obviously, that's not what one would do. One would selectively vaccinate in areas where it's breaking out to try to contain it through a measured and strategic approach. But this gets us back to the beginning of the conversation. You cannot do that unless you are testing broadly, not just sick people, but people they've come in contact with. And there's a bit of a chicken egg thing here. Our slowness in getting the testing up and going is an impediment in a great number of ways. But I'm cautiously optimistic about a vaccine, but it's not going to be very soon, not in the, you know, the frame of the epidemic.
And I'd also like to ask you, we talked about testing earlier. We need to know, like, how much of this virus is out there, you know, what the level of it is. But, you know, I noticed that the testing is ramping up, like, for example, in our area. But you almost need to, like, randomly test the population to get some idea of what's going on, I would think. So having people just voluntarily test, can you tell us about some of the problems, you know, from an epidemiological point of view with that? Because it's like, if there's a testing site, well, why would I want to go get tested? You know, what would be my motivation for that if I don't feel sick?
There's two separate questions here. The first is general surveillance testing. And some nations have done this. Germany has been very aggressive in this regard. New York just started doing it in some ways with the antibody test, because the question is, what percentage of people have been infected? And the viral infections will not be evenly distributed across the population. You're going to have clusters here and there, not everywhere. And unless you're random testing, you may not know where the clusters are. And therefore, you can't use public health measures with contact tracing and, you know, public epidemiology to help control the spread of the virus, especially if, you know, you don't want the entire country shut down in perpetuity. And obviously, we can't survive that. But the only other choice is either let it happen unabated or intercede in some way that is neither shutting down our entire country forever or just letting it happen. And the way to intercede is through focused interventions and quarantine and contact tracing. And we need the general testing for that, especially asymptomatic people, because if you've come in contact with a sick person, I need to test you to know if you're carrying it and spreading it to others. So that's a very important part of it. And then the other part of it is when people are sick, you need to know if they're sick with COVID-19 or, you know, it's still, I mean, it's the end of cold and flu season, but there are lots of ways to get sick that are not COVID-19. And there are therapies for those approaches, and the diseases are different. So just from a diagnostic standpoint, it's important to get tested if you're sick in that way. And so we're basically flying an airplane where the windshield has been spray painted in black, and that's no way to, you know, to fly a plane.
You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. Today we're hearing from Dr. James Zimring, professor, blood pathologist, and author of What Science Is and How It Really Works. More just ahead. This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Dr. James Zimring is a professor of pathology at the University of Virginia and has written a book called What Science Is and How It Really Works. Zimring recently spoke with NSPR's host of Blue Dot, Dave Shlohm, about COVID-19 and the role of science in this pandemic. Let's get back to their conversation.
This disease itself is manifesting itself in many different ways. Like, for example, I saw that it's starting to affect a small percentage of children, pediatric cases, in a strange way. And then we saw the information about people having blood clots and strokes. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, all the different ways that this disease is, you know, is affecting the human body in different age groups?
Yeah, you know, it's not uncommon for a single infectious agent to cause different manifestations that seem, you know, even shockingly different in different populations. So in the elderly and in other groups that are vulnerable either to pre-existing conditions or other factors, as everyone I think is aware, the primary problem is the lung, and here it's the ability of the lung to oxygen, you know, allow oxygen to enter your blood. And I want to make a distinction here between the infection and the disease. They are not the same thing. How your body responds to the infection often causes the disease. So the inflammatory response in the lungs, you know, the cells in your lung are just this very thin little slit of cells that allows gas to exchange. And if it gets inflamed and covered with, you know, scar tissue or pus or other things, the gas can't go across. That's the disease. But that can be separate from the infection. But the lung illness is what is afflicting older demographics and vulnerable demographics. And these are people who wind up on ventilators or even on bypass machines in extreme cases and have a reasonable mortality rate, which has been this horrible thing that we've all been watching unfolding. In people in their closer to their 30s and 40s, who have a lower mortality rate, though, have been showing up in the hospital having strokes and blood clots that are indicative of an activation of their coagulation system, which can also happen when you're inflamed. And then in children, we've begun to see rarely, but remember, if you have 350 million Americans infected, you're going to see rare things emerge. Inflammatory syndrome throughout the body that inflames the blood vessels, and it resembles a rare disease that's called Kawasaki's disease, which happens in kids and can have multi-system manifestations. A lot of the kids, many of the kids are gratefully recovering, but in extreme instances, it's resulting in death as well. And it may very well be that there's also, you know, rare manifestations of the disease that we haven't seen or haven't appreciated in other subgroups. But this is not a one-size-fits-all symptom package of COVID-19 infection. And we're learning an awful lot at a very high price, of course, as this unfolds.
Okay, I'd like to shift a bit and get your take on the scientific response to this and the messaging that's going out from healthcare professionals and scientists like Dr. Anthony Fauci and others, and, you know, how that's being received by the American public or not. I'd like to get your take on, you know, how science is being communicated and how it's being received.
Yeah. So, first of all, I have great respect for Dr. Fauci and everyone engaged in this process. And I've been very happy and proud, actually, of the narrative that they have been putting forward. The role of the scientist in these instances is to give the most accurate information possible, the best interpretation possible, and to try to come up with the most effective interventions and remedies as fast as we possibly can. The world is full of uncertainty, and nothing is guaranteed. No one can predict the future. However, based upon experience with other coronaviruses in the past, our growing experience with this coronavirus, and everything we're learning, and this is the whole community. This is the frontline healthcare workers who are reporting that people are getting strokes as much as the basic scientists working in the lab. We're learning more and more about the illness. So Will science get things incorrect here? Sure. But the more we learn, the better our predictions get. And it is rational to believe something that is probably true. It's certainly more rational to believe something that is probably true than randomly throwing a dart at a dartboard. However, I think a lot of the debate here are issues of policy, not issues of what you're going to do with the scientific information that's been generated. I watched Dr. Fauci's testimony very carefully, and what he basically said, and I agree 100% and respect, is he said, listen, I am not here to tell you what your economic policy should be. I'm not here to tell you what your public response should be. I'm here to tell you that in these different scenarios, if you do X, Y, and Z, here is the cost in human life that we predict. Here is the cost in human illness and suffering that we predict. And this is how we're seeing it. And people keep trying to draw the science into a public policy debate saying, you're saying we should, you know, shut down the economy, or you're saying we shouldn't do this or that. And that's not the role of science. The role of science is to say, here's what's going to happen if you do this. And then it's society's decision to make.
Yeah, and we have made a decision, it seems to me, to start reopening, like here in California and a lot of states. And, you know, I'm hearing lots of mixed messaging coming from public officials. And I think a lot of it is they kind of want to cover their rear ends as much as they can. So they don't tend to communicate really very transparently. So I'll just put it that way. So when we talk about, you know, reopening safely, you know, quote unquote, you know, what does that mean to you?
Well, I don't want to say reopening safely. I'd like to say reopening as safely as possible. Right, that setting aside all of the tragedy around people dying from COVID-19, and it's really, you know, horrible and unimaginable. There are all kinds of other issues at play. There are people who are not going to the hospital, even though they're clearly having a heart attack because they're afraid of getting infected from COVID-19 in the hospital. There are people who need biopsies for a lump that they found somewhere, who've been putting them off, you know, for months, and therefore their cancer diagnosis and treatment is going to be delayed. And let's not forget, of course, that, you know, while we have tens of millions of people in the high-risk group for COVID-19, we also have tens of millions of people who are food insecure, who are insecure in their housing, who have to survive in their own way. And so I don't envy the politicians trying to balance those needs. But to answer your question, if we are to reopen, which it seems, at least in some capacity, we must, for goodness sake, let's apply all the resources and technology that we need in order to do it with as few deaths as possible, as safely as possible. What that means is widespread testing without a barrier. What that means is tens of thousands of public health officials hired to epidemiological studies, to do contact tracing, to do all the hard work that is necessary to try to limit the spread of the disease and the deaths that will ensue while we are opening. That's what opening safely or as safely as possible means to me. We don't have an effective therapy for COVID-19 right now other than supportive care. We don't have a vaccine, but we have the testing technology and we have epidemiological expertise. And unless and until we use those resources, I don't think we're opening as safely as we can.
And then lastly, for, you know, somebody listening to you, what would be the big message you want to get out to the listener about not letting our guard down and still, you know, trying to live your life and go on and enjoy life as much as you can, but still being a safe and responsible citizen?
Well, again, you know, I appreciate the question, and I want to be mindful of the fact that you're asking me my opinion on things that are not part of my professional expertise, other than the healthcare and science side of it. I think that it is a reasonable expectation that we should be mindful of the vulnerabilities of our fellow citizens. That when we engage in unnecessary reckless behavior, and by that I mean ignoring social distancing, having contact in large groups when we don't need to, et cetera. We are not just making a decision about our own safety. We are making a decision about the safety of others and without their consent. And I think we need to be mindful of the fact that in an epidemic like this, I guess as always, but maybe more so now, what we do matters. And we need to pay attention to the guidelines and the recommendations, because not to do so is basically a depraved indifference for your fellow citizens, if not yourself.
Well, I'd like to thank you for your time, Dr. Zimring. It's wonderful to talk to you again, and I highly recommend your book.
Oh, thank you.
It's a great way to learn about how science really actually does work, the ins and outs of it. And I appreciate your candor, because I think, you know, we do need clear communication from all of our leaders and scientists like yourself.
Well, listen, it's been great to talk to you. And once again, I really appreciate you inviting me to talk.
That was Dr. James Zimring, professor of pathology at the University of Virginia and author of the book What Science Is and How It Really Works, speaking with NSPR's Dave Shlohm. You can find this interview and Dave's previous interview with Zimring that aired on Blue Dot about his book on our website, mynspr.org. And that is your program. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Special thanks to Dave Shlohm. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30, or you can catch the rebroadcast the following weekday morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.